Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The heart-wrenching loss of 9/11 was followed by a gut-wrenching sense of national vulnerability. If Al-Qaeda could hit the Pentagon, the World Trade Center, and almost the White House, it seemed they could hit anywhere. Fear ran high. Experts imagined endless possible angles of attack. Americans braced themselves for another blow and told themselves never to be caught off guard again. Tonight on Point, 3 years on and no second attack so far by Al-Qaeda. We'll ask why. We begin tonight in Washington, where America's first Secretary of Homeland Security, former Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge, resigned yesterday. The Department of Homeland Security was established to be the domestic bulwark against terrorism. Ridge's impending departure raises questions about the department's role and future. Joining me now from Washington is Mimi Hall. She covers Homeland Security for USA Today. Mimi Hall, thanks for being with us tonight.
You're welcome. Nice to be here.
So it's all playing out there, this vast bureaucracy that Tom Ridge put together. And I guess the first thing to go to is just the conversation about who's going to succeed him and what that conversation tells us about how central to the anti-terrorism efforts of the U.S. The Department of Homeland Security is today. What's the talk in Washington now, Mimi?
Well, it's a little unclear. You know, the White House has surprised us with a couple of these new appointments, and we don't know. Asa Hutchinson is certainly among the front runners. He's the number three guy at Homeland now. He's in charge of border and transportation security, and he's in charge of about 110 of the 180,000 employees at the department. You know, it's pretty clear that this president chooses loyalists, that's very important to him. Another name that's come forward is the former police commissioner in New York, Bernie Kerik. Some of the New York papers, or actually Newsday, was today reporting that he recently sold $5 million of stock in a company called Taser, which prompted speculation. That's a stun gun company that he would have to sell that because of ethical concerns. The White House Homeland Security Advisor, Fran Townsend, somebody Bush likes a lot, although she has no real management experience. There are a lot of names floating around, and we just don't know yet.
Mimi, how is this position seen in Washington these days? Is it seen as, I mean, it's a heavy responsibility. At the same time, is it seen as a plum job, is it seen, I guess, more importantly, as being at the heart of the action around security or not?
Well, I'm not sure I'd say it's seen as a plum job. It certainly is at the heart of the action around providing security. That's the department's function. However, because of the way it was set up, because Ridge lost some turf battles on intelligence collection, for example, because John Ashcroft at the Justice Department had sort of sharper political elbows and Ridge lost some of those turf battles, it's not seen as such a heavy-hitting position, say, as the Attorney General. You know, there are still turf battles with the FBI, CIA, et cetera, and Homeland is sometimes viewed as kind of a backwater when it comes to those kinds of issues. But when it comes to securing the country, I mean, that's what they do.
But is it a surprise to people who remember what a big head of steam the announcement of this department had when it first came online? Do they feel like it hasn't panned out to be the main actor that it was originally conceived as, or at least presented as, for a while?
Yeah, I would say that's true. I mean, it was conceived by some, probably never quite by this White House, but it was conceived by some as sort of, it was going to be the center of the universe of the new post 9/11 world, where the government's, you know, number one mission was to protect the American public, and in doing that, some wanted the department to be the collector of all intelligence, the analyzer of all intelligence, but now the department is just pretty much the recipient of it, and they've had a hard time recruiting folks to do that kind of work because it's not seen as the main place for that. It's seen as more the, you know, the place that puts the Coast Guard guys out on the water to patrol and the you know, orders local police or suggests anyway that local police stand guard in front of buildings and at airports and that sort of thing. And that's really become its role.
And Mimi, we're talking tonight about why there hasn't been another attack since 9/11, a major attack on U.S. soil. In Tom Ridge's circle, in the Department of Homeland Security, do they genuinely take credit for that, or do they feel lucky?
I think some of both. I don't think anybody really knows the answer as to why we haven't had an attack. At his press conference yesterday, Ridge said, you know, that if you asked him if any attacks had been thwarted over the past 3 years, that he would say yes. But if you asked him could he prove it, he would say no. But he said they believe that through CIA interviews with some detainees we have, that all the deterrent moves that we've made on aviation and elsewhere, that those have actually thwarted attacks, deterred attacks, that sort of thing. So they do believe that, and they do take some credit for it, but they also acknowledge they can't prove it, and we don't know for sure what motivates the terrorists. And finally, they also say consistently that they do expect more attacks. So a
lot of murk out there as Tom Ridge goes away. Mimi Hall, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Mimi Hall, reporter for USA Today. She spoke with me from Washington. When al-Qaeda hit the United States so dramatically on September 11, 2001, terrorism seemed instantly and horribly likely to be a new fixture of American life, maybe even everyday life. But more than 3 years have passed, and a second blow on American soil still hasn't come. Anyone with an imagination can come up with half a dozen ways that terrorists could hit the U.S. hard, and al-Qaeda has proven that it can plan and execute. So why hasn't it happened? We knew it was only a matter of time. We were told. We held our breath for a second attack. And now you may wonder if the U.S. pushback is working in Afghanistan, in Iraq, at our airports, if we're actually getting it right, or if everything's going according to some dark plan. This hour on Point, we ask how the U.S. has escaped so far a second attack on its soil by al-Qaeda. You can join the conversation. What's your gut tell you? Is the homeland more secure now? Or is al-Qaeda just biding its time? On 9/12/2001, would you have guessed that 3 years later there would have been no second attack? Is the threat still real to you, or is it slipping away? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Peach Bottom, Pennsylvania, is Christopher McDougall, staff writer for The New York Magazine. His story, Reasons They Haven't Hit Us Again, is the cover story of this week's issue. Chris McDougall, thanks for being with us tonight.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So you went out and did a great big story on this, and of course New Yorkers care about this more than anybody. They got the heaviest blow on 9/11/2001. You found a lot of reasons, and some quite surprising ones, I must say. But let me just ask you first, when you sit down with security experts, Christopher McDougall, and put the question to them, what kind of response do you get?
Yeah, it's really strange, and it's the strangest set of interviews I've ever done for any story in my career, because you're talking to experts, and they're breaking down the moves, and they're telling you the logic. But at the same time, you can sort of sense in their voice that they don't quite believe what they're actually saying. It's like a chess master describing the moves of a game, but still can't believe who's actually winning.
Do they seem, in general, surprised that the U.S. has not been hit again in this time?
Yes, but again, it's that war of emotion versus logic. They can give you the logic. They can say, well, you know, al-Qaeda this or Homeland Security that. But in the back of their minds, I think they recognize the same thing that we recognize, the same thing that I thought was so brilliantly illustrated in the article with that one photograph of just a little kid's school backpack in an empty parking lot. Like, that's all it takes.
That's all it takes. So walk us through, if you would, the rationales that these people who think about it all the time put out there when you went out and asked them, why not? Why hasn't it happened?
Well, the first thing they all said almost immediately was, boy, we wish we really knew. We're all talking about this all the time. This is the mental chess game we're all playing.
Mm-hmm.
But they basically broke it down to, after talking to a lot of different people, there was sort of a distillation of five major points. Would you like me to go through all five of them for you?
Well, plunge in. Let's see.
Okay. One of them is, you know, we've all been on al-Qaeda time for a while. They're not playing by our calendar. We're playing by theirs.
Al-Qaeda time. What does that mean?
Al-Qaeda will wait 8 years between attacks. They'll wait 6 months between attacks. They'll hit the USS Cole and then wait. Or even before they hit the Cole, they tried to float a little inflatable raft out to another boat. That didn't work, so they waited a year, got another raft, and tried again. They didn't try it the next day.
But in time terms, are they saying 3 years, 2 months, and 19 days is not too long? Wouldn't you think Al-Qaeda would want to keep the drumbeat going to keep a country terrorized, if that's their point?
Well, they waited so many years between the other two attacks in the World Trade Center that what seems like a long time to us could be very short for them.
Okay, so that would suggest the possibility that the intention is not diminished, but it's simply on its own pacing.
Exactly. I mean, one of the ideas was that we have this notion that bin Laden, pulled a Houdini and made a narrow escape in the hills of Afghanistan. There's an opposing theory that, no, he planned that all along, that he was long gone before U.S. troops got there, because he always expected that once he hit the World Trade Center, that there will be hell to pay, and so he planned to disappear for a very long time afterwards.
And he's on his own calendar. Okay, so Al-Qaeda time may not run on the fast cycles that ours does, or at least on the cycles of our anticipation. What else?
Well, the next thing, too, is the standard model that terrorists have sort of always followed everywhere, which is that they're basically like a guerrilla army, and a guerrilla army hits where you're weak, not where you're strong.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, New York is a hard target, so it's not in their interest to suffer casualties for hitting a target that's too well fortified.
Is it that well fortified? I mean, we always hear about the harbors where so much could still go on, the tunnels, the bridges. Is New York really a hardened target?
Again, this is where the experts are sort of pulling their hair out, because on the one hand, they give a tremendous amount of credit to the New York Police Department for basically defying all obstacles and turning themselves into probably the best Homeland Security operation in the country, even bettering the federal operation. At the same time, they also point to the fact that anybody could put a volatile bit of cargo into a container vessel and float it right into Newark Harbor.
But these things get determined, as you say, a bit at the margins. And if it's hardened since 9/11, even if not perfectly, that makes the hurdle higher. What else is on your list?
The next thing, too, is it was a real surprise, was that there's a lot of criticism of the CIA, and the consensus being that they don't have the feet on the ground to deal with the mouth-to-ear communications of an organization like Al-Qaeda.
Right.
They're used to doing great high-tech intercepts, but they're not going to have people who have infiltrated the Middle Eastern terrorist operations. However, we have an unexpected ally. According to some of the CIA experts I talked to, they said that the French have really helped us out.
The French?
The French have helped us out because the French have been dealing with Arabic-speaking insurrectionist operations for decades, and they have very well-developed counterterrorism operations and infiltrations in Arabic-speaking communities.
So intelligence information, even if it's not originated by U.S. services, what else have you got?
Well, that's one of the things, too, that surprised me was it's actually sort of comforting notion of spies as brothers in arms. And one of the people I spoke to was a former CIA operative, and he said, down here in the trenches, we don't care about politics. We're all about getting the bad guys.
Mm.
So all this buzz about the French not helping us among the spy network, that doesn't exist, and we're all helping each other get these guys. The next thing on the list was the question of, all it takes, though, is that guy with the dynamite in the backpack.
So right.
Why haven't we seen him yet? And this is something that's kind of interesting, too, sort of breaking down the psychology of the suicide bomber. And there are a couple different strands of why that hasn't happened. Part of it is the fact is that even though it's one person, it takes a pretty well-developed network to get that person in position.
All supplied and ready to go. And we've just got a half a minute before the break, Christopher McDougall, but your final little headline here is bin Laden isn't a terrorist, he's a killer. What does that mean?
Well, it's one thing that really stuck in my mind. Someone said, he's not trying to scare people. He's trying to kill them. He's not going to put a little bomb on the subway. He's going to put a big bomb into a tower. And that's why he's holding back. He's not going to do something small to scare people. He wants to get as many casualties as he can.
In other words, and this gets back to Al-Qaeda time, he would wait until that major opportunity presents itself.
Just as he's done in the past.
But did anyone say to you, we really, and beyond New York, because of course it's a bigger country than that, as big a target as that may be, we're just not vulnerable? Surely we hear the vulnerabilities described again and again.
Oh, no, everyone feels that way. And what was sort of surprising, even while experts were telling me what a good or how fortunate we've been, they didn't have a whole lot of applause for Homeland Security for the Bush administration.
We'll come back and look at that. Christopher McDougall with New York Magazine. Please stand by. We're talking tonight about, well, the question, how the United States has escaped so far a second terrorist attack on U.S. soil by al-Qaeda. You can join the conversation. Do you imagine that U.S. agents have quietly thwarted attack after attack while you were snug in bed? Or is Osama just patiently crafting his next extravaganza? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're asking tonight how the U.S. has escaped so far a second terrorist attack on U.S. soil by al-Qaeda, about why there's been no follow-up attack to 9/11 in all this time, more than 3 years now. You can join the conversation tonight. Is George Bush right? Are we fighting them over there in Iraq instead of over here? Is the U.S. constantly improving its security, or could it be dropping its guard as time goes by without an attack? And does U.S. security look tight as a drum to you now, or is it still hugely vulnerable? And if it is, why hasn't al-Qaeda struck again? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Christopher McDougall. He's a reporter for New York Magazine. Terrific piece in the magazine in the current issue called Reasons They Haven't Hit Us Again. We're joined right now from Columbia, South Carolina, by Peter Cederberg. He's professor of political science at the University of South Carolina, author of Terrorist Myths, Illusion, Rhetoric, and Reality. Peter Cederberg, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Happy to be here.
And with us from New York is retired Coast Guard commander, senior fellow and expert on homeland security and border control at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of America the Vulnerable, Stephen Flynn. He was director of the Council on Foreign Relations Independent Task Force on Homeland Security Imperatives that was co-chaired by Gary Hart and Warren Rudman. Stephen Flynn, welcome back to On Point. Good to have you again.
I'm delighted to be back with you, Tom.
Peter Cederberg, let me turn to you first there in South Carolina. What's your sense? You remember how everyone felt 3 years ago. It seemed it was only a matter of time. We've been told repeatedly it's not a matter of if but when, and yet it hasn't happened. You've probably heard some of Christopher McDougall's findings on this. What's your thought? Why not?
Well, I read the article with great interest and appreciation, and I am one of the quote-unquote experts who, I guess, he sensed the ambiguity in my voice and my comments.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the ambiguity arises from, I guess, the tendency of academics to see both and rather than either or. We could be thwarting and they could still be planning. We could be having our successes, yet they could still be plotting our failures. And, of course, that means when we say, yes, we could have thwarted, and yes, we have had successes, nonetheless, we know that we have not eliminated al-Qaeda as a threat. And, moreover, we must remember that although there has not been an al-Qaeda attack on the United States that succeeded in the last 3 years,
mm-hmm.
there have been al-Qaeda terrorist attacks around the world, starting first in what you might say it was the Islamic heartland, from northern Africa to Turkey to Indonesia, and then, more striking, in Madrid. And that certainly caused me to pay attention because that was the first major attack outside of the Islamic world.
Sure, it's not as if there's been nothing going on, and yet the fear, the vivid fear at that time, was that it would happen again here. The anthrax came not long after. Who knows what that was? It doesn't seem to have been al-Qaeda, but everybody thought, well, this is it here already. And it hasn't come. We don't need an either-or answer, but where does your tortured academic analysis take you on this, Peter?
Well, my tortured academic analysis, my greatest concern is that they are still out there, they are still planning, and of course, they also are, I think, focusing on Iraq. Why engage in major logistical efforts to attack the United States when the United States has thoughtfully moved significant targets into Iraq, and particularly when you see it in the context of bin Laden's own personal history? I cannot help but believe that bin Laden sees his experience in Afghanistan as being a defining moment of success, and defining moments of success tend to shape how we perceive our lives afterward.
That is him looking back to when the Soviet Union was booted out of Afghanistan in failure.
Exactly. And if you read his most recently released speech, that's really what he centers his analysis on. how he is doing again to the United States what he and the Mujahideen successfully did to the late and lamented other superpower.
Stephen Flynn, how do you interpret what's going on here? We want your big analysis, but how about just that point for starters? That would seem to be something along George Bush's line, that Osama bin Laden is happy to fight with us there instead of here. Does Iraq make the United States safer, the war in Iraq?
Well, I'm also one of the many folks with a heavy level of ambiguity on just what motivates and turns these Al-Qaeda. I guess one, of course, we have to deal with that Al-Qaeda has moved from an organization to a movement, and that is there's a lot of imitator radical jihadist groups operating.
Right.
They learned on 9/11 a way to hurt the West, in the United States specifically, by exploiting our openness and basically spooking us into potentially overreacting. We continue to see, obviously, this activity playing primarily outside the United States, so we have seen these incidents, as relayed just earlier. But I think it's a common, you know, what's a little bit of the mixed record is that Osama has talked about before 9/11, the success of creating massive economic disruption as a useful objective, and was very close to the mark in calculating precisely how much mayhem he caused. I don't think he expected the level of economic fallout.
You mean from 9/11, 2001?
Right, but he pretty much, you know, was able to go down sector by sector and say, this is what we were able to accomplish. It seems I'm of the school that because they don't have unlimited resources and because they want to be quite successful, then when you carry out any operation, particularly a small-scale one, you open yourself up for some sort of forensics after the fact.
Right.
We can pull the yarn back and pull you out here. They want to be successful, so I sort of share the Al-Qaeda clock thesis. And the willingness to do something spectacular means they'll spend more time on the planning, on the logistics, and they're in that phase. And I don't think we should be lulled into complacency at all.
Now, it's I realize, impossible to interpret how Al-Qaeda sees its own clock, and yet we want to push our minds as deep into this as we can. Do you imagine, here we are, three years and 2 months and counting, do you imagine Al-Qaeda is impatient to hit again with their project of the United States or not?
I don't think they're impatient. I think they will be willing. They will spend the time to be successful. They think time is on their side. And in terms of the growth of the movement, I think, you know, they're seeing success in that regard, in terms of sort of general sympathy and imitators growing. So they could probably take some solace in the fact that they seem to have more allies within the radical Islamic world. But for me, the core issue is one that I think the United States just simply hasn't come to grips with. And Tom Ridge was, to some extent, somebody who had struggled against this day in, day out. It is that the only way, as we look to the future of warfare, catastrophic terrorism, quite simply, will be the weapon of choice for every current and future adversary of the United States, precisely because the traditional options just aren't viable. The United States will spend more this year than the next 30 nations combined on conventional military capability. And by 2008, we'll have more than everybody else combined, and it's lethal stuff. So that says, I mean, there's only two possibilities about the future of warfare. The first is, you know, very dumb adversaries will take this stuff on. Or secondly, they'll adapt for your weaknesses. And it turns out we have a very big weakness in the West. We have open global networks that underpin our power that can be exploited and targeted.
Such as
our transportation, logistics system, energy, information, finance, intellectual capital, all the networks that underpin globalization and generate the wealth of the West, are networks that were driven by market imperatives of openness, efficiency, reliability, and low cost. And security was viewed as raising costs, undermining efficiency, undermining reliability, and putting pressure to close the system. So we built essentially our edifice of power on a foundation that is insecure, and when you're looking at an adversary who sees modernity in part as part of the challenge, and willing to sort of tear it down, and then we get a much different world. And so, relatively speaking, national security continues to get about 95 cents on every dollar. There's the traditional stuff. Tom Ridge was playing with basically this year $20 billion new dollars. The Department of Defense, national security community, our efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan collectively come in at about $500 billion.
So all kinds of vulnerability in the open network side. Meanwhile, billions and billions on fuel and tanks and helicopters and the old military stuff.
Well, that's right. And while there was no question there was disruption of the command and control of al-Qaeda, with specifically the activities in Afghanistan, over time they could reconstitute. What we heard throughout the campaign, which was caused some dismay for me, and really both candidates gave us just different versions of this, which is that the best defense is a good offense, that we have to take the battle to the enemy so we don't have to fight them here. It's a very seductive logic, but offense is premised on that we have a military that's an effective counterterrorism force and that we have intelligence that will allow us to detect activity and prevent it early on, neither of which is going to be in play during this administration, certainly. For the next 4 or 5 years, we will not have a military being an effective counterterrorism force. It's because it's not trained and equipped to do that.
And it's got an on-the-ground war going on right there. Near Christopher McDougall, I want to turn to you for a moment here and come back to your headline that says Bin Laden isn't a terrorist, he's a killer. After 9/11, everyone seemed to feel, well, whatever this entity was, just wants to scare the hell out of us. You're suggesting with that headline, it's a much more targeted intention. It wants the outcome, not so much perhaps the fear, but maybe, as Stephen Flynn is suggesting, the impact that next time it might not be the towers, it might be open networks of the internet or power or transportation that would really go to the economic juggler vein.
That's very likely, but I think at least to follow the history of what's happened so far is, you know, he is depicting himself as a holy warrior, not a demon, a warrior, a person who kills. And that seemed to be exactly the model that he's been following so far, is that to show his legitimacy, to his viability as a leader, he's going to show that he can kill as many people as the U.S. Army.
Well, and there's the whole spectrum right there at once again, from economic damage to loss of life, and still the clock ticking and no attack. And we're wondering why. We're at 1-800-423-8255. God knows we don't want it, but you can't help wondering. Greg is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
Hello.
Good evening, sir. What's on your mind?
I'm just calling as the State Fire Training Director to comment on the funding that has been coming through to the nation's fire service through Homeland Security and their response to training for anticipated attacks.
Do you feel well funded, Greg? Are you ready to? Are you thwarting the next attacks with the funding that's coming from Washington?
Well, I guess I can relay two articles that I saw in emails in the last day or two. One was an article out of USA Today that has basically said that since 9/11, the nation's fire services have been quite decimated due to reduction in funding, you know, due to state budget deficits. And
So you don't see it pouring in. Greg, your phone line's a little tough, but we've got the point. Stephen Flynn, I think I better put that to you. Here's the State Fire Training Director in Wisconsin saying, well, don't look to me to thwart it. I haven't got the budget I need. The funds, resources haven't come through. What about the spending and the actions that have been taken within the United States to defend against further terrorism? Could it credibly be argued that those steps are sufficient, that they're stopping it?
I've heard that story relayed to me in virtually every major city in this country and by many state leaders as well. There's money for new tools. One of the biggest issues is there's no money at the state and local level for people, and that's actually the most important resource for both planning and executing these operations. And so in some cases, I've heard from major urban areas that they think they've actually lost ground on being able to deal with traditional hazards like earthquakes and hurricanes and so forth here, because the few people they've had have to spill over into planning these new sets of contingencies and grant writing and so forth here. So here's one of the great disconnects. You know, 2 weeks before this election, we had the vice president saying that the most real threat that we may be facing is a catastrophic is a weapon of mass destruction going off in a major city in the United States.
We remember it well.
We need to wrap our minds around that concept. Well, the reality is you go to every major city in this country and say, are you prepared to cope with that reality? And the answer is no, they're not. And so this sort of disconnect here is I really believe the vice president thinks that's a real threat. I think the president thinks that's a real threat. And I think, and certainly Senator Kerry believed it was. This was one point where there's convergence. But that has not led the national security establishment or the White House or Congress to go to state and local level and say, are we prepared for that contingency?
So not really acting on that. Let's get another call. Vernon's calling from New York City. Hi, Vernon. You're on the air.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Great, Vernon. What's on your mind?
Well, I think the thing that sticks in my mind is one of the things during the 9/11 Commission was that one of the conclusions they came to was that there needed to be a more creativity in terms of dealing with this situation.
Right, right.
And I think there's a marked lack of creativity. I mean, the thing is that the hijackers of 9/11, they attacked us with very, very primitive weapons and just a lot of planning. And we are forced to think in sort of two-year and four-year election cycles. And there were, like, individual FBI agents that said, look at these guys going to flight school, and no one wanted to listen to them. So now you create something like the Department of Homeland Security, which is another huge bureaucracy. You go after the boogeymen. You go after Saddam.
Do you feel safe in New York, Vernon?
I think we have a great police department, but I think that in terms of like right now, I feel fine. But I think that we're dealing with people that are thinking in long term. They're thinking long term.
Vernon, we've got it, and we've got another rough phone line there, so I apologize. I'm going to have to let you go. But Peter Cederberg, here's this issue of creativity on both sides. There is a kind of a vast battle of wits going on here. Is it possible to interpret who's winning that battle?
Well, that's my greatest fear, is that we're losing that battle. In The Fog of War, that wonderful documentary on Robert McNamara, one of his points that he made, which of course was underlined in the Cuban Missile Crisis, is that understand the point of view of your adversary. And it's easy to say Osama bin Laden, he's a killer, because of course his organization has killed massive numbers of Americans and others around the world.
Mm-hmm.
But what is the nature and grounding of his appeal? And I've always thought that if we look at Homeland Security as trying to thwart attacks once, as I put it, the terrorist attackers have rolled out of the end of the pipeline onto the New Jersey Turnpike, we're a little late in the day. We need to be going all the way back the pipeline to where this is all starting. And this does not mean that we can neglect the kinds of concerns that Mr. Flynn has underlined. I particularly like his phrase, from organization to movement.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to look at how we are generating the antipathy and the ferocity by our actions in the wider world. There was a recent report released by the Defense Science Board, an advisory panel to the Pentagon, that said the U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq have created a shared cause among otherwise divided extremists. And a perfect example is in Iraq, where you have Islamic extremists uniting with secular Baathists.
And for all that, no second follow-on attack on U.S. soil. Are you heartened by that in some degree, Peter Cederberg?
I'm heartened that nothing has happened in the past 3 years, but I don't think we can rest on our laurels and look to the back, and you know, look back 3 years and say, "Wow, we made it." That's a little bit like the you know, the classic story of the guy falling out of the Empire State Building halfway down. So far, so good. We need to look at what we're confronting, and a catastrophic attack, I think, is one hard reality. But a far more immediate and obvious reality is the reality behind what Osama bin Laden says his strategy is.
Peter Cederberg, hold the thought. We've got to take a short break. Stephen Flynn, Christopher McDougall, we'll be right back. We're asking how the U.S. has escaped so far a second attack. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're asking tonight how the United States has escaped so far a second terrorist attack on its soil by al-Qaeda, about why no follow-up attack to 9/11. My guest tonight, Stephen Flynn, he's senior fellow and expert on homeland security at the Council on Foreign Relations, retired Coast Guard commander. At University of South Carolina, Peter Cederberg joined us, professor of political science there and author of Terrorist Myths. And Christopher McDougall is with us, reporter for New York Magazine. Terrific piece this week, Reasons They Haven't Hit Us Again, answering the big question in New York Magazine. You can join us as well. What do you think? What's your gut tell you? Is the homeland more secure now, or is al-Qaeda just biding its time? And is the threat still real to you, or is it slipping away? Is it changing? Your perception of it changing with time? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Josh is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Josh. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to. I was listening to you and your guests and some of the callers. I didn't hear anybody suggest that maybe the reason we haven't been attacked for 3 years is that maybe the threat of an imminent terrorist attack has been a little bit overblown. We have leaders that are coming on all the time and telling us, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when and things like that. And terror alerts that are going up to red, then back to yellow, then to red. But I wonder if, the amount of people who are really dedicated to traveling to the U.S. to attack us here is really relatively small in the world. And I think we need to begin to wonder if some of this, the rhetoric surrounding these attacks, is a little bit more politically motivated than anything else.
Oh, Josh, it's a provocative question. Let's pick it straight up. Stephen Flynn, what do you say to that?
Well, it's a hard one for me because, of course, I've been working this issue from well in advance of 9/11.
And your book is America the Vulnerable, so you're making the other case.
Yeah, and it was, what was painful about this pre-9/11 was that was the general feeling across government.
Mm-hmm.
That this is just catastrophic terrorism is just not the way these guys are going to operate. We didn't need to plan and sort of go for it. And now, unfortunately, I think for most Americans, the only experience with this is just 9/11, that one instance. We don't see this trajectory that goes back to the mid-80s of scaled-up activity directed at not just the United States or the Western targets that culminated in this attack. But, of course, we had World Trade Center, the first strike back in 93, as well as the one in 2001. So, and I guess I could accept this argument to some extent if we were also saying, we see that the need for ballistic missile defense as a small issue, that we don't really need to have conventional forces to fight two wars simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
That if we weren't spending $500 billion on traditional national security apparatus because we said we'll live with the risk, we don't have much. But for me, the disconnect is we continue to invest in the traditional way in which we carry out war.
A huge investment on that side, but not a comparable one on this side. So there's not consistency there.
Yeah, not an either or. It's that we need to have some balance between offense and defense because our offense is limited capability. We don't have the intelligence we'd like, and we don't have the counter-military capability that's for this kind of threat. So if you have to look around and say, what is very valuable and what is vulnerable, and if you don't think you're going to get advance warning, you begin the process trying to protect it. And it also is important to understand that many of the sensible measures we should be making right now are things that are not especially costly and can make a big difference between the potential loss of hundreds of lives versus tens of thousands of lives.
And you're talking about things that aren't being done, as I read you.
Exactly. And
what about chemical plants, nuclear plants?
Mindset of, we do it over there so we don't have to do it here. And this adversary is just not going to cooperate with the notion that we can continue to treat the war on terror as a way game and we can just go about our lives unencumbered by the new reality here at home. We've got to work our way through this. This is the new warfare that will be maybe not tomorrow, not next year, but this is how warfare will play itself out in the 21st century.
Both sides now. Lisa's calling from Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hi. I don't know if this is too simplistic of a thought, but terrorism, I mean, we're talking about it on the radio right now.
Yep.
And we're talking, I mean, we have the color alerts and everything else. Could not Al-Qaeda and or other groups be sitting back and going, we're getting them every single day? The amount of money that we've budgeted into Homeland Security, the amount of money that could go to other social programs. You know, we're saying another attack in the financial district would drop us on our knees financially. Slowly but surely, aren't we doing that at this point in time as a result of what happened 3 years ago?
Kind of self-bankrupting when you add everything up.
Exactly. I mean, it was one attack. And I mean, I truly believe that there, something is going to happen again. But every single day, this country is now being affected by terrorism.
You're suggesting it in a way that they win even when they're not attacking. Hate to look at it that way, but I know exactly what you mean, Lisa. Thanks for that call. Christopher McDougall, in your interviews, did you hear that perspective laid out that they don't have to attack to have an ongoing and negative impact?
Well, we've had foreign enemies in my entire lifetime. The Cold War was a pretty big ticket item as well. That's the price you pay, I guess, for being a targeted superpower. What I heard more than the idea that Al-Qaeda is winning by keeping us on the alert here at home is that Al-Qaeda is winning by keeping us at war in Iraq, that we're spending a ton of money over there and with more to go. And that's where, and you know, Bin Laden. I was actually sort of surprised because I think it was actually you, Dr. Cederberg, who said almost the exact same thing to me, that Bin Laden must be rubbing his hands with glee with the amount of money we're spending in Iraq. And then a couple of days later, his video is released where he says exactly that same thing.
So he does keep talking to us. Peter Cederberg, you were talking about that, Bin Laden's thinking. And I want to get your follow-up on that, but also this question about, at this point, 3 years and some after 9/11, what's your sense? Who's in this contest, if it's still an active contest, and I guess it is, who's calling the tune? Who's got the whip hand, the initiative?
Well, right now, I'm afraid they do. I think they have the initiative in that they have tied us out in a foreign war. Once again, he's investing relatively little. He's getting, I don't know if we can even speak of him investing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it gets back to the point about he's now has a movement. He has this disparate, decentralized movement of, in many cases, strange bedfellows who are united in their animosity to the United States in particular and increasingly to the secular West in general. This is very disturbing, and that's what I mean. See the world from his perspective, and I begin to draw the disturbing conclusion that he and those who support the view and see the West as being a threat to Islam and want to convince as much of the Islamic world that we are a threat to Islam, that we are an enemy of Islam, that things are going well, that they believe things are going well. Now, should we be concerned about this? Yes, I think we ought to be, because this is part of our security. And your previous caller about the notion that in some sense he is still succeeding. Sure, he hasn't killed 1,000 people over here, but he's killed or the war has cost over 1,000 American military lives, I believe, well over 100 civilian American lives. So, I mean, Americans are still dying in this struggle, and again, getting back to this Defense Science Board report, it's not a problem of information. That's what Rumsfeld said. Well, we'll take this report and we'll see how we can communicate better. But it's how we are perceived.
Stephen Flynn,
we've just got freedom. They hate our policies.
Policies, not the freedom. And there to Bin Laden's thinking, and you're saying he wants the U.S. out of that region. Stephen Flynn, what about the vulnerability here? It's the title of your book, but at this point, how severe a threat could terrorism pose? We've just got a minute, but could this country, this republic, still be taken down, or have we hardened it in such a way that that's no longer possible?
My biggest worry is not what terrorists can do to us, but what we can do to ourselves post an attack when we get spooked. And that is directly going to be related to how well the public perceives preparations being made, straightforward preparations to be made to protect the things that are most valuable for us. We've heard a lot of rhetoric in the last 3 years about how much is being done to secure us. The reality on the ground is that many things aren't much different than they were on September 11th, and I think Americans will be appalled when they see how little has been done on this side and that how all the eggs virtually have been put into take the battle to the enemy basket.
We've just got 10 seconds. Is it still a matter not if but when, Stephen Flynn?
Absolutely.
Not if, but when. Stephen Flynn, author of America the Vulnerable, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Peter Cederberg at the University of South Carolina, author of Terrorist Myths, Illusion, Rhetoric, and Reality, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Christopher McDougall, who laid so much of this out in New York Magazine, a terrific story, and you're great to come on tonight. Thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a new art exhibit portrays the faces of fallen soldiers in Iraq. This is On Point. When California art professor Chester Arnold opened his New York Times this past September 9th, he was struck by a display of one-inch mugshots of the 1,000 soldiers who had been killed in Iraq to that point. He came to his students with an idea for each student to paint a portrait of one or two of those fallen soldiers as a tribute. The response he received was overwhelming. Before he knew it, someone was working on a portrait of every one of the U.S. troops who had died. The result is a poignant new exhibit of nearly 1,100 portraits at the College of Marin's Fine Arts Building titled Never to Forget Faces of the Fallen. In this radio diary, Chester Arnold recalls the day he first brought the idea of creating portraits of lives cut short in Iraq to his class.
When I took it into class and presented it, the response was just overwhelming and immediate, and I found that students were willing to not just do the usual one or two faces in interpretations, but they were actually willing to do 10 or 15 or 20 or more. And I realized at that point that with that, as many students as I work with and as my colleagues work with at the community college, that we could actually probably, or at least attempt to, cover all of these individuals who really, we all felt the same way, that these individuals really deserved more of a memorial than they were getting in the New York Times on that day. And it was a project that ended up covering the entire political spectrum. I mean, I have students of all political persuasions, and all of them universally had similar reactions to the project, which was, you know, I got to know this person, I got to care about this person. And in the course of painting them or drawing them as they did, we found that they're not only learning about the human face, but they were learning about it in a way that was much more meaningful than anything that we had ever experienced before, either in my career as a teacher or an artist, or in their careers either. People coming in, what they're going to see is a room with approximately 1,100 5x7-inch panels that have been either drawn with graphite, charcoal, painted with watercolor, acrylics, oils. All are basically as faithful a rendition of the face that they, or faces that they encountered, as they could come up with. The paintings actually filled a lot more space than I thought it would in our college art gallery. What seemed like a vast space became very small, and we actually spread the images around, which is part of what is overwhelming for both the people now involved in this and people coming into the gallery as it's now hung, is that, you know, we know what's happened. We know, we've read about it. We've seen even pictures one by one, or we've maybe even seen that spread on the 9th of September. But when we see these images, which are really the interaction between individuals looking at the picture and then the person in the picture itself, which I'm reminding always my students that these are pictures that were taken of people who were living at the time. So we're having a kind of ghostly relationship with them, and it was ultimately a really respectful one. And there are an awful lot of people crying as they come into this because they just feel the enormity of it and the enormity of the human content. It's been an experience that's really allowed people to see what, maybe it's that distance that art creates, that it, the interpretation and the result of that relationship between the artist and their subject has produced something that allows us to feel we're in a safe place, we're in a place where we can take the time to contemplate what that relationship means, both the relationship of artist to image, and then the relationship of viewer to artist and image. And there is a kind of wordless dialogue, I think, and this is one of the reasons why I've got involved in the arts in the first place, was that the attraction of that wordless exchange that happens in the visual arts, which I think is so powerful, and especially in painting and drawing, that really requires us to slow down that process of observation to really get the most out of it, unlike many of the faster-moving visual media.
Chester Arnold is professor of fine arts at the College of Marin and creator of the new exhibit, Never to Forget Faces of the Fallen. The exhibit will be open until February at the school's Fine Arts Building in Kentfield, California. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.